from chapter 8 through to the end. And through that section, we saw a great theme that emerged through those chapters: glory and greatness. At the start of that section, Peter acknowledges that Jesus is the Christ. That's in chapter 8, verse 29. The promised King and Rescuer. Through that section, we also get to hear titles for Jesus. We get to hear the title, the Son of Man, the King of everyone, the one who will reign in glory. Jesus says he will return in his Father's glory. In this section, we get the Transfiguration, a picture of Jesus, risen glory, God's Son, the one that he loves, the one that we're called to listen to. So the greatness kind of dominate this section from chapter 8 onwards. But we've also had a kind of negative look on greatness as well. We've had the disciples arguing between themselves, who is the greatest now? In the passage before the one that we're looking at today, we had the rich man, one who looked great in the eyes of the world because of what he had. There's lots about greatness in this section. But for Jesus, greatness, glory, isn't for now, but it's for the future. Something else had to come first. Something else had to come in the present. And that was lowly, humble service. And we also hear a lot about that in this section as well. And we hear about how Jesus will suffer and be rejected, and how he'll be delivered into the hands of men and killed. We hear about how all who come after Jesus will have to deny themselves and take up their cross and follow him. And we hear how the way of Jesus will be costly, sacrificial service of others. Suffering and hardship now, glory and greatness later. And that isn't always an easy thing to face as Christians, is it? In a world that pursues and desires greatness now, it's hard to live for a greatness that only comes in the future. In a world that values power and impressive looking things, it's hard to embrace a life following a crucified king. Life as a Christian is often far from what the world would consider great. Often it may not even be considered great by those closest to us. Living a lowly and humble life, thinking about others, embracing costly sacrifice, it's just hard, isn't it? And that can be tough. It may cause us to ask the question, is it really worth it? Is this difficult, different life now worth it for a glorious life later on? Here's what the passage tonight will show us. It shows us that greatness will come, but costly sacrifice comes first. Greatness will come, but costly sacrifice comes first. It shows us that the way up, the way to greatness, is the way down. It's the way of sacrifice and humble service of others. The way up is the way down. Let's read together our passage, Mark chapter 10. We're going to read verses 32 to 52. Now they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going before them, and they were amazed. And as they followed, they were afraid. Then he took the 12 aside again and began to tell them the things that would happen to him. Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him. And the third day he will rise again. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And he said to them, What do you want me to do for you? They said to him, Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory. But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They said to him, "We are able." So Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared." And when the ten heard it, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. But Jesus called them to himself and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Now they came to Jericho. As he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great multitude, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the road begging. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Then many warned him to be quiet. But he cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." So Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called. Then they called the blind man, saying to him, "Be of good cheer, rise, he is calling you." And throwing aside his garment, he rose and came to Jesus. So Jesus answered and said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man said to him, "Rabboni, that I may receive my sight." Then Jesus said to him, "Go your way. Your faith has made you well." And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus on the road. I wonder how many times in your household, or maybe with family or friends, there's an argument that develops and you kind of work through it. It's kind of resolved. But then sometimes later you scratch the surface of that topic again and the issue comes up and all the arguments begin again. A similar thing is happening here in this passage. In chapter 9, the disciples have been arguing about who is the greatest. And despite showing them the way of the cross, this issue is still rumbling on in the background here. We see it as we hear the request of James and John right towards the start of our passage. Did you see what they asked Jesus? Verses 36 and 37. "And he," Jesus, "said to them, 'What do you want me to do for you?' They said to him, 'Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory.'" They still wanted greatness, didn't they? So what will convince them, what will convince us that the way to greatness is that way of costly, sacrificial, humble service in the present? What will help us to really believe that the way up is the way down? Well, there's three things I think we come across in our passage tonight. Three things that will convince us about the way to true greatness in the future. Looking at Jesus himself, looking at the call for all who follow Jesus, and then looking at how those who follow call. We'll see those things as we go through. So how do we see that the way up is the way down through looking at Jesus, first of all? Well, just go back to the start of our passage. And we get the third prediction in Mark's Gospel of Jesus' death. Just see what he says there in verse 33 and 34. "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him, and the third day he will rise again." This is the third prediction of Jesus' death, and we get even more detail this time when Jesus talks about it. He's going to be condemned to death by the Jewish authorities. He's going to be handed over to the Gentiles, and then we get more disturbing details about his suffering, his mocking, how he'll be spat on and scourged and then killed. Jesus knew the exact details of what he was about to face. Perhaps that isn't news to you. But do you know what is incredible? What is new here in this prediction? Just recognize what accompanies those predictions. In verse 32, we're told they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going before them. Jesus knows what's going to happen in Jerusalem, but he's leading the way there. He knows what he's about to face, that suffering and rejection and death. But he goes. The Son of Man goes on his way to die. But that's not the end of the story, is it? All three predictions of Jesus' death talk about how he's going to die and suffer and be rejected, but also what will follow. At the end of verse 34, after 3 days, he's going to rise again. Do you see, this is the very pattern that Jesus is wanting to make clear. The way up is the way down. The path to risen glory comes by the way of the cross. Greatness will come, but first of all, death comes. The way up starts with the way down. That's what we find as we look at Jesus himself. Jesus sets the pattern. The way up is the way down. Greatness will come, but suffering and death comes first. But we also find that's the pattern when it comes to all who follow Jesus as well. And that becomes clear as we look at James and John's request to Jesus. Just have a look at their approach again. Verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory." It seems that James and John have cottoned on to the fact that Jesus is going to be exalted. And they want to secure the best positions, the greatest positions with Jesus. They want to get those positions of greatest honour at Jesus' throne on his right and his left before all the other disciples get a chance to ask Jesus. But Jesus exposes their ignorance, doesn't he? Just have a look at his reply in verse 38. But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" That might seem a strange reply at first. But when we look into it, we see that Jesus is using this image of the cup and baptism as powerful symbols to show what he's about to face. Just listen to these words from Jeremiah 25. Jeremiah 25, verse 15. Just see how the cup is used in these verses. "For thus says the Lord God of Israel to me, take this wine cup of fury from my hand and cause all the nations to whom I send you to drink it. And they will drink and stagger and go mad because of the sword that I will send among them." The cup represents God's anger at our sin. It's a powerful picture, having to drink the dregs of the wrath of God because of the people's sin, because of their turning away from him. It's a similar picture with baptism that Jesus is using here. He's comparing baptism to being like waters that rise to overwhelm people. So could James and John drink this cup, face this baptism? Could they suffer in place of people for our sin? Well, the answer is clearly no, isn't it? Only Jesus is able to take God's anger at our sin upon himself. But there is a similarity. James and John are still called to walk the way of the cross. That's how verse 39 follows on. There will be a way for James and John to drink a similar cup, to face a similar baptism of suffering as they deny themselves and follow Jesus. And that becomes clear as Jesus addresses all the disciples. Just see what he says in verses 43 and 44. He says, "Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all." Jesus says, if you want greatness, it only comes by going down, by becoming low. True greatness isn't achieved in the way that it's so often achieved in the world, through people showing how powerful they are, or issuing demands that other people simply just have to obey. Instead, greatness comes through service, through becoming a slave of all. And we're not left wondering what that looks like, are we? Because Jesus goes on to point to his own example, to tell us what he's going to do and why he came. That's where verse 45 fits in. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." This is one of the most glorious verses in the book of Mark, in the whole of the Bible, in fact. This is the contrast again. The Son of Man, the glorious Lord, has come to give his life, to die as a ransom, to lay his glory aside and die on the cross for our sin. That's what ransom is all about, isn't it? Someone taking the place. Just imagine, if you went down the hill here in Ashbourne and turned the corner, you'd find quite a bright orange car. That's our car. Just imagine if one day we took our car and we drove to Buckingham Palace and we parked it outside Buckingham Palace, ignoring the sort of yellow lines or red lines, I think it probably is outside Buckingham Palace. And we went off and looked at all the sights around London. And then later in the day, we came back and we found that our bright orange car was no longer there. It'd been towed off to the pound. That would be right, wouldn't it? We'd done something wrong. We'd parked our car where it shouldn't have been. It's been towed off by the authorities. So off I trot to the car pound, and I'm in the queue waiting to go up to the desk and pay the release fee. And I suddenly notice there's someone that looks kind of vaguely familiar in front of me. And then I recognise that it's King Charles. And he's just about to take out his card, and he's going to pay the release fee for our car, for the wrong thing that we did. That begins in a very small way and slightly funny way, I guess, but to show the wonder of Jesus' words in verse 45. Jesus is the only one without sin. There was nothing for him to pay at all. Yet he came to serve us. He came to pay our ransom, the King, paying the price for us. And the way he did it was to give his life. The ransom Jesus pays is drinking that cup of the fury of God because of our sin. That's how Jesus serves us. That's true greatness, isn't it? Do you notice three things about that service? It's immensely costly. Jesus gives his life. There's no greater cost that he could give. It's incredibly humble. The Son of Man, the King of everyone, stooping so low that he takes up the cross and dies in our place. It's immensely costly. It's incredibly humble. But it's also willing. It's obedient. Yeah, I wonder if you know the next time we hear about this cup of God's wrath in the book of Mark. It says Jesus is on his way to die and he's pleading with the Father to take this cup from him. But do you remember his reply? "Yet not my will, but yours." They're incredible words, aren't they? Jesus knew what he was going to face. He knew the indescribable horror of the cross. Yet though he had wanted to turn away from it, he prayed to his Father, "Your will be done." He was willing to serve. He was willing to obey his Father, even at such great cost. And you see what that shows us about greatness? Greatness comes through sacrificial service. The way up is the way down. And this is the life that Jesus calls all who follow him to. What might that look like? Well, it might look like a family that we're getting to know at the moment, who are moving down towards the Midlands from a church situation where they're part of a big church, everything is quite settled and stable. They're moving down to the Midlands to start a new church in an unreached area of the Midlands, with lots of risk, with lots of small things going to come to them, with the cost that that all entails. That's maybe one example of costly sacrifice. It's like a man called Jeff, a quiet, unassuming gentleman at one of our previous churches. But one of the reasons why we as a Selby family were able to afford the move to Hilton. Without any ceremony, he sent a donation to our bank account, and it meant that we could afford the move to Hilton. He didn't want any thanks, he didn't want any fuss about that. He died a few weeks later. That's what greatness looks like, isn't it? Greatness through service, through humble service. But it looks like us. It looks like us every time we love and trust Jesus enough to do hard things for him and for the growth of his kingdom. Every time we put ourselves out again to serve someone who on the surface doesn't seem to deserve it. Every time we feel that cost of giving our time and our money and our energy to church so that other people can hear the gospel. Every time we open up our lives and our home and give ourselves to hospitality and all the cost that comes with that. Every time we work endless hours to prepare for Boys Brigade camp and other initiatives in the town so that people can hear the good news about Jesus. Every time we cross the room to talk to and value that person that others try and avoid. It even includes the everyday, the mundane aspects of life. Every time we put ourselves out in the middle of the night to care for and serve our crying child. Every time we prepare another meal or fold clothes or undertake 100 other thankless tasks in the home because we love and serve those around us. Why do we do it? Because, verse 43, whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. Why do we do it? Because Jesus first served us. Because this is the way of true greatness. For all who follow Jesus, the way up is the way down. We see it as we look at Jesus. We see it as we hear the call for all who follow Jesus. But finally, we also see it as we look at how those who call follow. This is where we go to the final part of our passage, to the story of Bartimaeus. Jesus is still on his way to Jerusalem, and the route that he takes leads him to Jericho, through Jericho. Do you remember what happens as he leaves Jericho? Have a look at verses 46 and 47 again. Now they came to Jericho. As he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great multitude, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the road begging. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." You can imagine the kind of PR disaster for all those around Jesus, can't you? Here is the great King Jesus. In the very next verses, he's going to be welcomed into Jerusalem with palm leaves and cloaks thrown on the floor. But now he's met by Bartimaeus. Bartimaeus is spoiling the picture. This disheveled blind beggar. Someone you'd want to keep out of the way of greatness. Be a bit like if King Charles was to do a tour of St. Oswald's Hospital. Everyone's poorly there, aren't they? But the king would only really be shown to the respectable patients. Can you imagine the shock if he was taken to see down and out someone in tatty clothes suffering from some horrible illness? That's not what kings do. That's what the crowds are thinking here. Jesus' greatness and this man's lowness are incompatible. Jesus must avoid Bartimaeus, and Bartimaeus must stay quiet. But as much as Bartimaeus is told to be quiet, the more he shouted. Can you imagine how uncomfortable that must have been for the people around Jesus? Children, have any of you got a loud voice that you'd be prepared to use? It doesn't matter if not. Don't worry. Can you imagine, though, if the children here, just now, just tonight, amongst us, were bellowing out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on us." Can you imagine if they kept doing that? It'd be very distracting, wouldn't it? It'd be quite uncomfortable after a while. Can you imagine how it would have felt being there with Jesus, with all the crowds around him, this great king, and Bartimaeus constantly shouting in the background, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on us." It'd be hard to ignore, wouldn't it? And you see how Jesus didn't ignore it? The start of verse 49. Then many warned him to be quiet, but he cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Sorry, that's verse 48. 49. So Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called. When Jesus gets to see Bartimaeus, just have a look at the question he asks. It's the same question that he'd asked James and John previously. We find it at the start of verse 51. So Jesus answered and said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" It's the same question that Jesus asks, but where James and John had asked for greatness, Bartimaeus simply cries out for mercy. Where they wanted to be seen at the right hand of Jesus, Bartimaeus simply wants to see. And just look at the happy outcome for Bartimaeus, verses 51 and 52. "At Rabboni, that I may receive my sight." That's his answer to Jesus' question. Then Jesus said to him, "Go your way, your faith has made you well." And immediately he recovered his sight and followed Jesus on the road. That word there, "your immediately received his sight and followed Jesus on the road," "your faith has made you well." That word there, "well," is the same word as "it saved you." Do you see what this shows us about greatness? How people are saved? About how those who follow Jesus call in the very first instant? Salvation comes through weakness, not greatness. Salvation comes through throwing ourselves on God's mercy and the power of Jesus. That's what becoming a Christian is all about, isn't it? It's not about any efforts of ourselves. It's about asking Jesus to save you. I wonder if you've realized that. Have you asked Jesus to save you? That's the only thing that we can do. Have you humbly cried out to Jesus for mercy, just like Bartimaeus did? Bartimaeus shows us the way. He shows us that salvation comes through weakness, not through greatness, not through anything that we do of ourselves. It's another demonstration that the way up is the way down. And you see what encouragement, what hope that gives us? Very few of us will be able to achieve greatness in the world's eyes. Very often that will be beyond our reach, won't it? We can't always achieve what we'd like to do. We can't always live as Christians as we'd want to. But that's not the basis of our relationship with God. That's not how we're welcomed into Jesus' kingdom. It's not by our own efforts. It's not by being great in the world's eyes. Instead, the greatness of salvation comes through the weakness of dependence. Jesus isn't counting on us to do anything for him, but on us depending on what he's done for us, crying out to him for mercy, just like Bartimaeus did. And any of us can do that. That's the life that Jesus calls us to. Or just think about the churches that we belong to. A few weeks ago, I was listening. I'm not quite sure why I chose to listen to this podcast. It was a podcast about a church in Australia that had thousands of people attending week by week. They'd got bands and lighting. They were thinking about how to cater for all these huge numbers of people. We could be tempted to think that's what greatness looks like in terms of the picture of church. It looks impressive, but it's also very different to our experience in Hilton and probably your experience here in Ashbourne as well. If you looked at Grace Church Hilton, we don't look powerful. We don't have everything sorted. We aren't all strong Christians. We look weak. There are lots of struggles. We don't have loads of resources. We're not seen as significant or important amongst the majority of people who live around us in Hilton. But Jesus turns greatness on its head. All through this section, Jesus is dismissing the disciples' quest for worldly greatness. He's turning it on its head, and he's showing us that grandeur and reward isn't for this life, but for the next. That life following Jesus is suffering now and glory later. But to be first means to be the first to serve, to be a servant of all. And we see it proved, we see it demonstrated by Jesus. We see true greatness as the Son of Man goes on his way to die. We see it as we look at the call to those who follow, becoming servants of all. And we see it as we look at how those who follow call. They call out and depend upon Jesus at the start of the Christian life and all the way through. Is that how you define? Is that how you know true greatness? Will you let Jesus define greatness rather than what the world says greatness is? Will you follow Jesus knowing that the way up is the way down? Let me pray that would be true of each of us tonight.